Hello and welcome to Current State for October 14th and 15th. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with the Mitten State lending a hand to what were once tropical paradises. Two Michiganders arrived this weekend in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, still very early in the process of recovering after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Lisa Castillo of Mason will help the Virgin Islands, while Langsberg native Aaron Mahoney will do the same in Puerto Rico. Before leaving for what could be a three-week assignment, they talked about volunteering with WKAR's Scott Pohl.
I'd like both of you to take a moment to tell me about what has motivated you to do this. Aaron, why don't you go first?
I was watching the news. I'm kind of a news junkie. And the Hurricane Harvey hit, and I was seeing the photos out of Texas, and it was just devastating. And I have a lot of free time, and I was like, I really need to go and help these people. And my mom actually brought up the Red Cross. We have a family history of Red Cross. I mean, my grandma went to Hurricane Katrina, and so I know how trusted they are, and that's the best place that I could use my abilities.
And Lisa, what's behind your decision to do this?
Almost the same thing. I was watching the news as well because I'm originally from Texas, from San Antonio, Texas, and I've been up here since 92. One of my cousins had put on Facebook that they couldn't find her dad, and he's in Rockport, Texas. And I was like, oh my goodness, and so I kept praying and stuff like that. And as I was watching all the disaster going on, and American Red Cross was there for me in two house fires back in 96 and 97, and just the love and the warmth and the compassion that they have. I was like, you know what? I think I need to sign up with Red Cross and give back, because they gave to my family, you know. And knowing that, you know, all my family's in Texas, I was like, you know, I need to sign up. And I thought I would get down to Harvey, but I had to take, you know, classes and things like that and trained. And so I didn't make it to Harvey, but it's okay because I can help other people as well from other hurricanes.
Since you were sent to Florida, tell me about the Red Cross preparation for doing that kind of work. And in your case, I'm curious about how they prepared you for Florida and if there's any different preparation for the work you might be doing in the Virgin Islands.
The preparation is pretty much the same. It's a training. It's just hands-on. Pretty much that's what's prepared me, and just, you know, having the knowledge, you know, of other things going on.
Aaron, is that pretty much your story?
Yeah, I was actually very impressed by the level of training that they gave us. On my little portal on the Red Cross website, it has me clocked at like 20 hours of training. It really was impressive. I mean, the local team has been really doing a great job making sure that they have classes scheduled in person to be able to train people to get out there for these disasters. But we also have supplemental online classes that we can go and take in order to fill other roles when it's needed. And it's just stellar.
We're talking with Aaron Mahoney and Lisa Castillo. The Red Cross is sending them to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, respectively, to do post-hurricane volunteer work. Now that you've told me about your preparation, I want to ask you both about your level of concern or worry about your own personal safety in these places. Let's start with you, Aaron. Puerto Rico, we're hearing about a shortage of water. There's no electricity anywhere. How concerned are you about your own well-being?
Well, I grew up rustic camping basically all summer. So I'm not really concerned about my safety as much. And I think that the amount of briefing that we've been given has been enough to, I think, prepare me to go down there. They told me that there were centipedes down there that grew up to 12 inches long, mm-hmm. and that they loved boots and that they loved sleeping bags. So make sure you dump your boots in the morning and dump your sleeping bags at night. I'm not down there, you know, for a vacation. Mm-hmm. I'm down there to help people. So I'm not so worried about the way I'm living as long as I'm helping other people.
Lisa, I want to ask you about the Virgin Islands, because we frankly haven't heard so much about the Virgin Islands since Puerto Rico was hit so hard. What are things like in the Virgin Islands now, and what's your own personal level of concern?
Well, I don't exactly know what's going on down there. I just hear of things. I know I've kind of trained myself. I took it upon myself to watch some YouTube videos of the hurricane effects, and I've seen centipedes.
Snakes.
I am scared of snakes, but you know what? At this point, I have to set that fear aside, because I could not imagine what them people, the islanders, are going through, fearing for their life. So a snake to me is not going to bother me. I'm there to make sure that no lives are lost, because they don't have food, they don't have water, they don't have shelter.
They actually recommended that I grab a walking stick while I'm there to smack logs to make sure there weren't snakes on the other side.
Right. So exactly.
It's hairy down there. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it, but we're down there to help.
Right.
Lisa Castillo is headed to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Aaron Mahoney is going to Puerto Rico, both as Red Cross volunteers after the hurricanes that have devastated those two places. Thank you both for coming in, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
New developments in the case of Larry Nassar, the former MSU doctor accused of sexually assaulting many young female gymnasts. Shayna Roth was in court on Friday. And Shayna, what was this about?
Well, the new development is essentially that there isn't going to be a new development to some extent. Both parties agreed that they wanted the jury selection and the trial to essentially be put on hold until the federal charges against Nassar were wrapped up. He has a few child pornography charges out there that he pled to in federal court. He is awaiting sentencing on those charges. What both sides said is, you know, this could potentially harm his right to a fair trial, because anytime anything Nassar related comes up, every news outlet is going to be writing about this. And so if we are trying to pick a jury while a big development, such as being sentenced in another case, happens, well, then you can't possibly find jurors that aren't going to see that and be impacted by that. And then the judge essentially said, you know what? We have jury instructions for a reason. We specifically tell all the jurors to not look at news articles, to not go searching or doing research or doing any, as you said, homework on the cases that they could be a part of. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep everything going as usual, because I have a docket to run and I can't be held up by a federal judge.
So Shayna, again, this was in Ingham County, and he faces charges also in Eaton County as well.
Right. And those charges are essentially on hold until Ingham County is wrapped up. So he has multiple layers of charges in various courts across the state.
Shayna also watches what's happening at the Capitol for us. And there's now a move to get rid of the State Board of Education, I understand.
Yes. So there was a committee hearing this week about this joint resolution. And a joint resolution is essentially an amendment to the Constitution. What they want to do is to get rid of the State Board of Education, the State Superintendent, and the State Board for Public Community and Junior Colleges. And they just had a committee hearing on it. They heard some testimony from different people, both for and against. And in order to amend the Constitution, the resolution has to be passed in both chambers by 2/3 majorities. And then it has to be accepted by the voters during a general election.
So the question is, okay, you don't have a Board of Education, so who is going to manage the public schools and colleges?
Right. So the resolution provides for a director of the Department of Education. And the logic behind this is, their argument is, having a board of a bunch of different people, they aren't really accountable to anybody. And essentially, it's a too many cooks in the kitchen argument. You know, you have this board, you have the superintendent, you have all these local boards. There's just too many people going around, and we can't come up with really solid policy because there's just too many people in the mix. And so if we have this director of education, we have one person who would be elected by the governor, and they would be the person that is responsible for essentially moving along with the governor and the legislature. Those would be the entities in charge of dictating public policy. for education. The argument against that is if you have a governor-appointed position, well, that person is essentially term-limited because a governor is term-limited. And if you have somebody that's term-limited, well, that's less accountability for that person because they know that it's a job that they're not going to have for very long anyway. They also argue that by taking the people in charge of education out of the hands of the voters, that that is suppressing the voice of the people and of the people who have their children in the education system.
And I imagine along partisan lines, there's kind of a divide on this.
Oh, absolutely. This is a resolution that was introduced by Republican representatives. And during the committee hearing, it was the Democrats that were being the most critical and really asking those tough questions of, exactly how does this create more accountability? Why don't we try something else? Why don't we do this? Because, the one thing everybody seemed to agree on the board is that something with Michigan's education system needs to change. It's not the current board, the way it is in its current form, isn't perfect.
Well, thank you for bringing us up to date. That is Shayna Roth from our Capitol Bureau. And you can listen to Shayna weekdays on Morning Edition and weekday afternoons on All Things Considered. Thanks again, Shayna.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. Supreme Court began its new term last week with a case that's destined to make history. For the first time, the court will decide if partisan gerrymandering is, in fact, constitutional. If you've forgotten your middle school social studies class, gerrymandering is when a dominant political party manipulates electoral districts to aggregate their base voters in a single area. Conversely, it also weakens the voice of the minority party voters. As the Supreme Court deliberates on redistricting reform, a citizens group in Michigan is hoping to bypass the traditional legislative process and put the job back in the hands of the people. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports.
In 2011, an interesting political fault line formed down the middle of Lake Michigan. Still struggling from the Great Recession, Michigan found itself the only state in the country to lose population in the 2010 census. When lawmakers redrew their political district map, the Wolverine state lost one seat in Congress. On the west side of the lake, the GOP took control of the Wisconsin legislature. But when their time for map-making rolled around, Democrats cried foul. They saw the huge swaths of Republican red as an overtly partisan power grab. A legal battle followed, one which now lies in the marbled halls of the Supreme Court. Walt Sorg is happy to see this day arrive.
Well, the fact that it's before the court is really important, that we are finally getting a judicial review of this issue. The basic argument is whether it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, because effectively gerrymandering means your vote is not worth as much as somebody else's vote based on where you live.
Sorg is a board member with the grassroots group Voters Not Politicians. He's watching the Wisconsin case. A 5-4 decision looks likely, with Justice Anthony Kennedy potentially tipping the scales as the expected swing vote. But even if the plaintiffs win, Sorg does not expect the court to destroy gerrymandering once and for all.
All they're going to do is send it back to the Wisconsin legislature and say, you've got a problem, fix it. What we're saying is, we're going to fix the problem.
Voters Not Politicians wants to see Michigan establish an independent commission that would bring redistricting out of the back rooms in Lansing. Their plan would appoint 13 members consisting of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. A 7-vote majority could pass a redistricting map, but only after an extensive public hearing process. Walt Sorg chides the shape of 3 GOP-held congressional districts, the 4th, the 7th, and the 8th. He says they're designed to bypass large Democratic strongholds, such as Ann Arbor. Bob LeBrant disagrees with the notion that something insidious is going on. He's an attorney and a former legal counsel for the Michigan Chamber of Commerce.
They use this phrase, voters should choose their legislators, not legislators choose their voters. Well, in reality, this is based on county boundaries. It's based on city boundaries. It's based on township boundaries. Nobody's choosing anything. They're basically stuck with where they live.
LeBrant says the Michigan Supreme Court built these standards along well-established geopolitical lines specifically to prevent partisan gerrymandering. He takes issue with Voters Not Politicians for creating what he views as a vague new standard.
Communities of interest. I know what a township is, I know what a city is, I know what a county is, but I don't know what a community of interest is, and that's probably the reason they chose it, because it could mean anything.
Walt Sorg offers an explanation.
You could say we have an ethnic community or religious community or an economic community that should be together. For example, agriculture. Right now, agriculture really kind of gets the shaft in redistricting because the ag communities are splintered out and they don't have nearly the influence that they probably should have.
Sorg envisions Michigan having a symmetrical political process. In other words, a delegation in Washington and a legislature in Lansing whose percentages mirror the total number of votes.
Right now, it's way out of whack.
Voters Not Politicians is in the midst of a petition drive to put a citizen redistricting commission on the ballot in 2018. So far, the group has collected more than 200,000 signatures. It's an all-volunteer campaign without the paid circulators that so often mark the modern petition industry. Attorney Bob LeBrant commends the group on its ground game, but he has his reservations.
In all likelihood, they're going to be successful in collecting those signatures. Whether they can survive a court challenge is something else, and we'll see.
In total, Voters Not Politicians must turn in more than 315,000 signatures by February to qualify for next year's ballots. Board member Walt Sorg believes the group could achieve that goal before the end of this year. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
This weekend marks the end of Hispanic Heritage Month, which recognizes the history and achievements of Latinos. Rocio Quispe Agnoli is a professor at Michigan State University who specializes in colonial Latin American studies as well as women and gender studies. WKAR's Karel Vega spoke with the professor about the evolution of Hispanic identity in recent times.
The term Hispanic is quite ambivalent and a fluid term and remains controversial since its inception. I think that a person's self-identification as Hispanic, Latino, or Latin American today varies a lot according to several circumstances as well as individual and societal factors. And what is interesting to ask for me is when I get comfortable with someone, or someone is comfortable with me, I should say, is what are you? How do you identify yourself?
Hispanic culture is often male-dominated. One of the most famous women highlighted when looking at the culture is the artist Frida Kahlo. In fact, if you go to the official National Hispanic Heritage website, she will be the highlight. Even then, Frida Kahlo's personal story is often paired with that of Diego Rivera. Who were some examples of Hispanic women to look to as role models?
There are several models of Hispanic women to look at, and I'm going to mention some of my favorite ones. One of them is Sonia Sotomayor, the Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. She has an amazing story of migration, immigration, and going, putting herself through school. She's a great role model. She's one of my favorites. Another one is Ellen Ochoa, who is an astronaut, the first Latina to go to space. And she's now director of the Johnson Space Center. I would like to go back in time. And another model is Chilean poet Gabriela Mistral, who won the Nobel Prize of Literature in 1945, and of course, Frida Kahlo.
In 2013, the Embassy of Peru here in the U.S. Acknowledged you as Peruvian Woman of the Year for your academic and literary contributions. Can you tell me about that?
I teach a course, an IIH course, that is called Native Latin America, in which I teach the conquest of Mexico and Peru, but from the point of view of indigenous sources. And it's an iDiscovery experience for the students. I received an award for that class, and the Peruvian Embassy liked that specific achievement a lot. And of course, it was a recognition of bringing Peru to the forefront of knowledge, of academic knowledge.
What do you think is the most interesting thing about the Hispanic and Latino community internationally right now?
What happens with Hispanics Latinos and Latin Americans is that we are defined by language. We are supposedly able to speak Spanish. That's usually the first assumption. And not everyone today can speak Spanish, at least fluently. And that is fine. But there is that assumption. And the fact that you speak Spanish immediately categorizes you in a group. You know, the people, an English-speaking person immediately puts you in a group of people. And there is an issue of embracing who you are, embracing your being Hispanic, Latino, embracing your language. And that is one way that you can empower people. If you speak English with a Spanish accent, love it. If you speak Spanish with an English accent, love it. Embrace the Hispanic or Latino or Latin American without you. Embrace also whatever may be foreign and beautiful. I'm sure it's beautiful. After all, in today's world, we are all a melting pot, and we should be proud of what we have.
I've been speaking with Rocío Quispe Agnoli. She's professor of postcolonial Latin American studies here at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much again for having me. Thank you.
For WKAR News, I'm Karel Vega.
Southern trees bearing strange fruit.
The daughter of legendary civil rights icon Malcolm X made a personal journey to Lansing. Ilyasa Shabazz was 2 years old when her father was assassinated in 1965. On Thursday night, she spoke at the Erickson Kiva at MSU, the exact room where Malcolm X addressed students 2 years before his death. On Friday, she laid a wreath at the corner of Michigan Avenue and Detroit Street in Lansing, the site where her grandfather, the Reverend Earl Little, was murdered in 1931.
It's a surreal moment to be in the area where our grandfather was killed. Where he was lynched in 1931.
The murder was one of several tragedies the family endured in Michigan. When Malcolm X was 4 years old, a white mob burned his family out of their first home in Lansing. His mother was later institutionalized, which divided her children among various foster homes. Shabazz says her father's work is known around the world and that Lansing has an opportunity to honor his legacy.
This is the area where he spent his childhood, his adolescence. Malcolm took the baton from his father, Earl. They were both humanitarians. They wanted equality, equal life. They wanted a quality education for their children. There's a light that's shining right here. So, you know, take advantage of it.
Straight ahead in the next half hour of Current State, a giant step back for Lansing in its attempts to set new regulations on medical marijuana.
Like a good neighbor.
Recognize that jingle? The man who changed advertising in America talks about our country's brand in the age of Donald Trump. Current State on WKAR returns after this.